From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Year by year, the world of video games is getting more sophisticated. Gamers know it. It keeps them coming back, diving in with the same kind of enthusiasm an earlier generation brought to a big movie or big novel. The big game out right now, just released, is BioShock Infinite, a $100 million production set in a kind of steampunk 1912 of theocracy and sci-fi, a floating city, xenophobia, racism, American exceptionalism, and of course, a mission for you. This hour on Point, where games are going, video gaming, and BioShock Infinite. You can join the conversation. Have you played BioShock Infinite? Is this what you're looking for? Action, immersion, story, big ideas. A little sound right behind us there, a little ragtime version of Tears for Fears, Everybody Wants to Rule the World, very eclectic musical selection in the backdrop to this really intriguing game. You can join us. Is this it? What you're looking for? Action, immersion, story, big ideas. How is a great video game like and unlike a great movie? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. And you can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Setting of BioShock Infinite, the floating city of Columbia, 1912, but there's all kinds of kind of sci-fi and even time travel woven through. The city is revealed to be a society built on racism. Early in the game, the protagonist, Booker DeWitt, voiced by actor Troy Baker, wins a raffle at a carnival booth. The prize turns out to be first chance to throw a ball at a tied-up interracial couple in a twisted carnival game. The player, as Booker, has to decide whether to throw the ball at the couple or at the carnival barker.
Over here, he's the winner!
Number 77, come and claim your prize!
First throw!
Twisted, indeed, from BioShock Infinite, a little wedding march there, interracial couple tied up, and you're, of course, the player if you're in the game. Joining me now in our studio is Ken Levine, creative director and co-founder of Irrational Games, creators of BioShock Infinite. He's a big figure in the video gaming world. He led the creation of BioShock and BioShock Infinite, also well known for his work on Thief, The Dark Project, and System Shock 2. His new big game is BioShock Infinite. The New York Times calls it a model of what the medium can achieve. Ken Levine, welcome to On Point.
It's great to be here, Tom.
It's a big project. It takes a long time. Am I right? It's $100 million-plus invested here and, what, 200 people who've worked on this?
Yeah, the numbers, you know, may be somewhat exaggerated. The reporting is somebody guessing. But yeah, but it's a big project. It's 5 years, and at times I think we had 150, 160 people. And, you know, we started out as a company of three people in a room. So it's the times changing the industry and the products, the scale, the ambition, the scope just keeps getting larger.
I can't even imagine what goes into creating all of this detail, the graphics, the software, the music, the options. How is your workshop like and unlike, I don't know, a Walt Disney studio circa 1939?
I imagine it's somewhat similar to like a Pixar production where instead of a film set where everybody comes together for a couple of months and works together and then they split apart, it's more like a company where you have everybody working together who's been there for years, their employees, and it takes a much longer period of time because not only are you trying to create an artistic endeavor, mm-hmm. you're inventing software at the same time.
Not just using, but inventing. What do you mean by that?
So, you know, all this world we have to make, which is a game, mm-hmm. we have to create a piece of software that makes that game.
That underwrites all of it, that undergirds all of it.
Absolutely. And so, you know, and we pull in a lot of different pieces of what we call middleware, third-party software to help that. But so it's like it's like a piece of this and a piece of that, something that does the facial animation, something that does the physics, and something that does the world building. But then we have to build all of our custom content on top of it. What makes all the buildings seem to be floating? What makes the character Elizabeth, your companion in this world, walk around and behave realistically in the world? So it's an art. As I said, it's a really harrowing technical endeavor, and then we have to make it all work on all these, the PlayStation and the Xbox, which are now 7 or 8 years old mm-hmm. pieces of hardware, mm-hmm. And make it look great.
Unbelievable challenge. I can just imagine the breadth of that. You've got your protagonist here. This is the, in the world of video games, this is the shooter, mm-hmm. But also with a mission to do. We heard from earlier there who's. Eventually, it turns out, is out to sort of connect with and bring back Elizabeth. He's been sent to this floating city, 1912, all kinds of gears and period sort of steampunk-looking graphics that go along with that. There's a little tape. Elizabeth, voiced by actress Courtney Draper. She's imprisoned in a tower guarded by a monstrous mechanical creature called the Songbird. She's suspicious of Booker, i.e. you, if you're playing the game, when he first shows up.
Not here to hurt you.
Who are you?
My name is DeWitt. I'm a friend. I come to get you out
get
of here.
Get away! No! Are you real?
I'm real enough.
He's coming. You've got to go.
There comes the Songbird. Are you real? What is real in the world of a video game? It's complex and many-layered. And I wonder, Ken Levine, creative director here, when a movie director, sets out typically with a script. Sometimes it's off of a work of fiction. Sometimes it's out of a screenwriter's mind. Sometimes his own. When a novelist sets out, there's some fundamental idea or impulse or framework. What do you begin with when you set out to, marshal all the forces required to create the world of a video game? Take this one. What's the starting impulse or idea?
Our first idea, we had a meeting one day and said, basically sat around and said, what interests us, as a team? Because if you're not working on something you're not interested on, you're not going to be able to spend 5 years on it.
Yeah.
And the first thing we came up with was the period. It was a very interesting period. It's an underexplored period in almost all media, in 1912.
That is before World War I. You're into the 20th century, but it's not the flapper era. It's not the Depression.
Yeah.
It's not the doughboys of World War I.
Yeah, but if you look at it and you step back from it from a historical basis, Tom, you have this is shortly after the Spanish-American War. You have America starting to spread its wings and take its place in the world as a world power, where mm-hmm. before that it was essentially almost like a very hermity type country,
right.
sitting off on its own. Yep,
mm-hmm.
And only with Roosevelt and things like the Spanish-American War, and from a technology basis. 20, 30 years before, you have basically people living as they always had for hundreds and hundreds of years.
Agrarian.
Yep, mm-hmm. yep. And all of a sudden, there's electricity, there's cars, there's movies, there's phonographs, there's airplanes. And then you have Einstein and Freud, all these people appearing on the scene redefining, in Einstein's case, redefining our understanding of the natural world in a way that still confounds us. It's still almost
yes.
impossible to get our heads around.
Sort of blowing the lid off people's minds and the world while it's still this world of old-fashioned giant gears
yep.
and industrial stuff at the front edge of development. The ideas even behind and beyond that. Out of that, you take these themes of American exceptionalism, lots of xenophobia, racism in here, and a theocracy. It had almost a forgive me if I'm totally wrong, but there's almost a Mormon-y feel here. I don't know what your inspiration was.
Well, it is uniquely the religion that this character, Father Comstock, who calls himself the Prophet, develops, is similar to Mormonism in the sense that he sort of reorients the center of gravity from Jerusalem to America.
Mm-hmm. They worship the founding fathers in your fiction.
Absolutely. They have, Father Franklin and Father Washington and Father Jefferson, and they have all these sort of icons with those characters, religious icons. So they develop this whole iconography in their own religion. That's, like like Mormonism, is sort of based upon a an earlier – is based upon the Old Testament and the New Testament. Mm-hmm.
But with a North American revision.
Absolutely. And with more of a focus – but there's a heavy Old Testament focus because he sort of views his city, Columbia, as an ark. Mm-hmm. He calls it another ark for another time. Mm-hmm. He views himself as a modern-day Noah.
And so with all these big ideas, and you've got white supremacy ideas in here and much more, but at the same time, there's still that fundamental through line of the shooter
yep.
in the game. Does that feel like a cage to you at this point? Would you like to break out of that? Or will that always be the necessary through line of a popular video game that someone's got a kind of a Luger or some gun in this case in his hand and is always shooting?
No, there's plenty of games that now that don't include any violence at all. I think BioShock, the story of BioShock, separate from you, if you never pulled a gun in the game, it's still a violent story. Violence is part of this world. You know, one of the main inspirations for this world, I remember looking at all these postcards of these lynchings from this period. Mm-hmm. And they were festive celebrations, you know, and they would send these cards out to their friends, you know, them sort of eating with a picnic basket, standing by a lynching. And the sort of casual racism and xenophobia of the period was just fascinating.
Ken Levine is with us, creative director, co-founder of Irrational Games. Their latest is BioShock Infinite. A little more from the soundtrack here. The player encounters a barbershop quartet singing a version of God Only Knows, the Beach Boys, 1966, but it's supposed to be 1912. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
God only knows what I'd be without you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the giant new video game release, BioShock Infinite. It's a video game blockbuster with brains. We're looking at what that means these days. The state of the art. Ken Levine is creative director, co-founder of Irrational Games, the company that's brought it out. He's with me in the studio. Behind us a scene where the player, could be you, engages in a firefight, jumping on and off of flying airships. It's 1912, and it's all over. A little sound from the game here. The game's primary antagonist, Zachary Hale Comstock, founder of this floating city, Columbia, prophet, leader. You frequently hear his voice during the game. Here he is.
To tax the black more than the white, is that not cruel? To forbid the mixing of the races, is that not cruel? To give the vote to the white man and deny it to the yellow, the black, the red, is that not cruel? But is it not cruel to banish your children from a perfect garden? Or drown your flock under an ocean of water? Cruelty can be instructive.
Cruelty can be instructive, says the prophet in BioShock Infinite. And here's a little bit. The city of Columbia is torn by a conflict between the ultra-nationalist founders, led by Comstock, and a rebel group called Vox Populi, led by a black woman named Daisy Fitzroy. The protagonist, Booker DeWitt, could be you, meets Daisy Fitzroy on an airship during the game.
I ain't looking for a fight.
There's already a fight, DeWitt. Only question is, which side are you on? Comstock is the god of the white man. The rich man, the pitiless man. But if you believe in common folk, then join the Vox. If you believe in the righteous folk, then join the Vox.
I just want my ship.
And the Vox shall give her to you.
Folks, this is not Super Mario Brothers. This is not Pong. BioShock Infinite, just out. The creative director, Ken Levine, is with me in the studio. And Ken, lots of callers. Patrick in Waterford, Connecticut. Thanks for calling, Patrick. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you. Hey, thanks to the whole team for making such a thought-provoking and really interesting game. I've been, you know, following the idea of gameplay as narrative for a really long time, and, you know, the antecedents of BioShock, like, BioShock, System Shock, and things like that, really bring forth this great idea of gameplay as narrative that kind of started for me with the classic game Half-Life. And so I was really interested to hear some thoughts about the idea of gameplay as narrative. And, these games are really approaching the quality of literature in terms of, like, what kinds of thoughts that they provoke and things of that nature.
Patrick, this one's just been out for a week. Have you played it yet?
Yes, I finished it on the hardest difficulty setting. I tucked right in and blew through it. It took me about 18 hours, and I died a lot, but it was well worth it.
18 hours, and you've gone all the way through. So what's your question for Ken? Here he is, creative director.
Yeah, well, it's great to talk to you. My question is, there's this really interesting emerging pattern in the storylines of the BioShock games where the nature of the player as agent is kind of twisted throughout the story. And I was kind of, the main character in all the games seems to be the focus of some kind of revelation about the player himself and about the choices that he's made. And I was just interested in hearing him talk about the process of developing that and what, some of the psychological considerations are of the experience of the narrative through playing the game.
It's an interesting question, Patrick. One of the great things about games, in fact, I think the most important things about games as a narrative tool, is you're not observing the story. You're a participant in the story. And that literally no other media can make that claim. It's almost like you're an improvisational group and that on this incredibly, fantastic set with an incredibly fantastic storyline. But what's interesting in BioShock Infinite in particular is usually a lot of story-based games, it's in what we call third person, meaning you're observing your character. In this game, observing your character walk around the world. In this game, you actually see through the eyes of your character. And so you are this interesting mix of yourself and Booker DeWitt. And our goal in this game was to actually make you feel as if you had a relationship, not necessarily a sexual relationship, but a bond with this woman, Elizabeth. And for the player,
who he's there to rescue.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And to actually build a connection, make them feel like partners. And if for one, I saw a great comment on Twitter the other day that a guy actually turned around and to ask Elizabeth a question, like from his own head. And of course, she can't answer questions, but he had that impulse to ask her a question, mm-hmm. which I found really gratifying.
How do you make that relationship feel real to the player, mm-hmm. so that you're not just looking at a cartoon kind of figure on that screen, but rather you feel as though you're in a relationship with a video game character?
It was a many-step process. The first thing I did is I stepped back and I said, what builds relationships with people? I thought of my friends and I thought of my wife and, how do we connect to each other as people? And, we help each other. We're interested in each other. We're sensitive to each other's needs and what's going on. And so we came up with ways for Elizabeth to be all those things. On the other level, she has to have a story that you buy into, a narrative that you can get behind, that you believe in and that you feel that she has goals that you're sympathetic to. And we put all those things together. And on top of that, we made her feel like she lived in the world. Most video game characters, companion characters, stand very stiff and
sort
almost
of hover
like robots
in some distant space.
Absolutely. Where we spent a lot of time and energy on making sure Elizabeth, while she walked in a room, that she behaved like a person. She leaned against the wall. She looked at things she got interested in. When people smoking that she walks by, she coughs and sort of waves her hand. We spent just a ton of time trying to make her feel normal on top of then making her this fantastical character.
Louise asks us online, how does this game work to change how women are viewed in video games? Of course, in many, they're just, sort of buxom ornaments that get blown up or abused.
I think in many ways, this is the story of Elizabeth. This is the story of a woman who goes into the world, essentially leaves a parental system where she's confined and we all have that experience of breaking free from our youth and going out, being thrown out into the world, sometimes not ready for it. Mm-hmm. And Elizabeth does go out in the world not ready, but it's about her growing up and becoming – really confronting a lot of things that even we as adults don't get to confront.
Here's an exchange between Booker and Elizabeth in BioShock Infinite. Looking here in this game to make her feel more real than many video game characters, acting, reacting – in her actions and reactions, including here in this little bit, being horrified and furious when she first sees Booker, the player character, kill
You're all dead. You killed those people.
Elizabeth, I...
You're a monster.
What did you think was going to happen?
What?
Do you understand the expense the people went through to keep you locked up in that tower? You think people like that are just going to let you walk away? You are an investment, and you will not be safe until you are far away from here.
What did you think was going to happen? I mean, that has a narrative meaning, but also it's a video game.
Yeah.
I mean, how often is a player pulling a trigger? Once every how many seconds?
It's a video game. It's fairly frequent, but it's probably significantly less than most shooters because we have a lot of story mm-hmm. to tell. Mm-hmm. I think what was interesting about that moment for us is generally characters in games don't acknowledge violence. It's
right.
just sort of a given. And I knew to write this character and make her believable – she had to have a reaction to that. She's a human who's never seen anything like that. But also it's her first step towards adulthood in the sense that Booker, who's been through this experience, who's seen everything. He's a former Pinkerton agent. He was at Wounded Knee. He's seen all this before, and she realizes he's right.
He says, you think they're just going to let you walk out of here?
No. Exactly.
Julian in New Orleans, Louisiana. Julian, you're on the air with Ken Levine.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Ken.
Hi.
Hey.
So I haven't owned a video game system in years. I gave it up because I felt like I had to focus on school and then work. But I'm going to go out and I'm going to buy a video game system just to play BioShock Infinite. And it's because, you know, I was talking to some friends and we were talking about movies that affected us. And I couldn't think of a single movie that really affected me. But on the other hand, when someone asked me about a video game or an experience, BioShock, the first one, always comes up without a doubt. And it's because of the emotional piece of it. It's because of the emotions that were wrought through the storytelling with the big daddies and the little sisters and the whole world that you created and the ambiance, the feeling like you were inhabiting a world that was not your own. And I guess I just wanted to say that there is no other experience that can kind of equal that, a passive watching a movie or a passive kind of even a book feels somehow more passive.
Julian, what's the difference? I mean, I'm sure people are listening and some will be thinking, well, but gosh, you know, I've read novels where I felt so deeply enmeshed that maybe it moved my life. I've been to seen movies that completely took over my emotions. You say it goes deeper with a video game. How and with what effect, Julian?
Well, I mean, I'm a voracious reader and I should say that, you know, but the sense of kind of, I guess, being invested in a world so deeply that you turn around to have a different experience within that game. You have this swath of experiences that you can choose to participate in. You can either go into a moment of intense violence or of strife, or you can turn around and just appreciate the beauty of something that you are kind of living in these shoes for a little while is so powerful that you... You know, some of my favorite moments in BioShock are moments of just appreciating looking out windows and, you know, kind of passively watching things go by me. And for some reason, there's just no other experience that is equal to it. I'm not saying it's qualitatively better. I'm just saying that it is so unlike anything else, and it's just so jarring and refreshing. I guess, you know, I had a question for Ken, which was just, where do you start if you're going to make a game and you know that it's going to be a game for first and foremost, but you want to make this a world, a living, breathing place, like how do you say, how the conclusion to come to Columbia or a Rapture, how do you decide which comes first, the emotional piece or the playability piece?
I think we always recognize that the believability of the world and the believability of your experience, despite how fantastical the setting is. I think that, Columbia being the city in our first game, being Rapture in our first game, being a city at the bottom of the ocean led by this sort of Ayn Rand-style mm-hmm, figure, mm-hmm. or Columbia, this floating city in the sky, they're both ridiculous places. They're both, you know, mm-hmm. they're absurd. Mm-hmm. But we try to make them feel actually more believable than most video games that take place in Afghanistan or wherever, because the people are motivated by real things. They're interested in real things. And that's, you know, whenever I'm writing a scene, just like any other writer, my first question to myself is, what do these people want? You know, what do people, what does this world want?
What's the motivation?
Yep. Mm-hmm. And the city is a reflection because it's a monoculture, because it's like the white city in the World's Fair in 1892 or Disney World. They're a monoculture. They're a vision of one, mm-hmm. of a singular mm-hmm. person.
In this case, the prophet.
The prophet, yes. And in the first game, it was this sort of Art Deco vision of Andrew Ryan. In this game, it's this this sort of neo-colonial vision of the prophet. And that monoculture and the sort of totalitarian nature allows us to project many of the ideas in the world as well as through the spoken message.
Julian, in New Orleans, for films, people put great stock in a particular director and his or her work, and you know, it raises certain expectations. What about in games? Is it? Do you see the fingerprints of Ken Levine in this realm, Julian?
Oh, sure, absolutely. I mean, in fact, I work in film in New Orleans, and it's really interesting because you have an entire art department. I work in the art department. You have an entire art department, and so much of what goes on is a consensus, and hopefully what you come away from the whole project with is you've chosen the right production designer, and they've left their mark, and it's very much them. And, of course, the director, you know, oversees everything, and he's the big boss. But Ken Levine's, or Ken, you're, I don't want to talk about you like you're not there, you're... The fingerprint that you leave is this sense that when you come away from this world, that you are truly leaving something behind, that there is a world that is living and breathing and waiting to be lived in, that there was a past to this place before you turned it on, and there will be a future to it. I mean, I don't know. I haven't played the rest of the story, but...
That's a mouthful. That's a mindful. Julian, thank you very much for calling in with that. Ken, stand by. I want to welcome Scott Steinberg into our conversation. From St. Louis, video game guru, innovation consultant, CEO of the tech consultancy company Tech Savvy Global. He's played BioShock Infinite also. Scott Steinberg, welcome back to On Point. Thanks very much for being here.
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
I'm well. I mean, I'm just, you know, I am not a gamer, but I'm looking out here and ready to learn and appreciate. And I see, I mean, this thing's being described as dense, inventive, exhilarating, mind-bending, moving. How did you find it, Scott?
Well, I have to say, I found it one of the most inventive and most exhilarating games I've ever played. And actually, it's ironically, for a first-person shooter, one of the things I found myself doing most often was simply stopping to bask in the atmosphere. And that seems to be Ken's signature, is that he makes the environment, he makes the backdrop and the storytelling, the atmosphere, as much a central part of the storytelling arc as any actual character. So living, breathing environment set in this satirized world, almost of xenophobia, racism, religion, all with the ghosts of the Civil War looming large, the Native American campaigns looming large over it, and can create some great contrast. And actually, one of the most interesting things I found was the interplay between Elizabeth and Booker, because the central question of the game seems to be, will you kill to save yourself? And if you do, is what's left afterwards worth saving? So she almost acts as your conscience, and I've never seen that before in a video game.
I mean, but that may be a question, but from the what I've seen of it, you're killing every time you turn around.
Well, there is violence, and the violence is oftentimes meant to create that contrast and to create that thought-provoking sense that really asks you every time you pull the trigger to second-guess yourself, because, yes, it's second nature, and, yes, it's a video game, and there is killing in there. It's a horror game, first and foremost, and so there is action to it, a first-person shooter game. And at the end of the day, let's be practical, right? From a video game standpoint, you have to create something that will grip most people. But in many ways, what Ken's done is create a Trojan horse here, where the violence is simply to get you in the game, to explain it to your average lay viewer, so that when you go to the GameStop or your local retailer, you understand what you're buying, and then creates this tremendous world, this sense of atmosphere and thought-provoking dialogue, thinking about, well, is the violence justified? And if it is justified, who's the bad guy? Because you referred to Booker as the protagonist. In many ways, he's an anti-hero. So
yes,
it's an interesting way to get the game in front of people and get more people thinking about it.
And we are in the world of the video game. Big one just out, BioShock Infinite. Scott Steinberg, please stand by in St. Louis. Creative director Ken Levine, right here with me in the studio. In the game, a lone woman singing a spiritual version of Creedence Clearwater's revival song, Fortunate Son. 800-423-8255. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
It ain't me. It ain't me. I ain't no fortunate one. No, no. It ain't me. It ain't me.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about the giant new video game release, BioShock Infinite. A little sound of ambient propaganda broadcast on loudspeakers throughout this fictional city of Columbia. Floating city, 1912. But there's a lot of time shifting in this video game. The creative director of the game and co-founder of Irrational Games, it's a producer, Ken Levine, is with me in the studio today. Scott Steinberg is with us from St. Louis, CEO at Tech Savvy Global, big video game analyst, and he has played this one. You've heard him enthuse. Let's go to Trevor right now in Los Angeles, in California. Hi, Trevor. Thanks for joining us. You're on the air.
Thank you, Tom. And again, Ken, just... I've been completely blown away by BioShock Infinite. I'm a lifelong gamer ever since I was 4 years old and my parents put Sonic the Hedgehog 2 in my hands, one of the worst mistakes they've made in their life. But again, I have never been thrown into a game universe that has stayed in my mind constantly the same way the creation of Columbia has. And my question for you, Ken, is about this world of Columbia, because there is, of course, the main storyline that Booker and Elizabeth are going through the whole game. And I have completed the game. Mm-hmm. It's, again, as I said, it's an amazing piece. And everyone at Irrational, you guys should all be proud of the job you guys have done. But you have this enormous second half to the story that can really only exist in games. Everything with the voxophones, these recordings that you can pick up as you're running around the city that are taken by these very important characters in the universe of the game, or just characters that you might not run into at all. The conversations that are happening with all of these civilians that you're walking by in certain parts of the game. This entire other half of the story that adds an enormous depth to the universe, but as I've been saying, is completely optional. What does it really take to formulate that entire half of things while being in the full knowledge that there's a very good chance that many of the people who play the game will never experience any of these, well, not never experience, but may very well likely miss many of these things that are happening in the game universe?
Trevor, if I may, why do you presume that? You're thinking they won't be able to get that far in the game, or they'll just won't bother?
It's not so much that they won't get that far, it's just that for these recordings that are throughout the game, these things that you can pick up or optionally choose to look at or optionally choose to go to, one that sticks out particularly in my mind is a moment where the character Booker can pick up a guitar and play a song to which Elizabeth sings to. And it's a completely optional moment. You do not have to pick up the guitar. You do not have to go to that part of the level where that exists. But at the same time, it's probably one of the more touching moments I've ever experienced playing a video game.
Trevor, I'm very grateful for your call. Yeah, let me put it to Ken. Ken, how much optional action do you provide here?
That's a great question. It's something you just have to accept as a game developer and embrace that people may miss stuff. But here's the theory, at least my theory, or at least what lets me sleep at night.
May miss stuff because they don't have to do everything. They can rush straight down the main
channel.
They can
rush straight past it. And you see people do that, and it's heartbreaking for us, but that's a gamer's choice, and that's choice. That's the key word here. The moment he described is a moment that's probably one of the most important moments in the game for me. But I made the choice that you could miss it, because finding it and not it being forced on you is so much more powerful than the team spoon feeding it to you. And when people find stuff, they feel it's like it's theirs. And that's what games do differently than any other media. It's their moment. It's not my moment. It's not Irrational's moment. It's their moment.
So you, as a creative director in video games, you're not just creating a narrative here, not just a challenge. I guess with this, you're presuming that you can actually mold the behavior of your gamers, because you sort of teach them by the rewards they get from looking around and interacting and slowing down, appreciating maybe that there's a payoff.
Yeah, I mean, and we try to reward people for doing that, and with the theory that if they get rewarded, they'll do more. If you make a corridor, this optional corridor, and you go down, there's nothing there. Obviously, people are going to stop doing that. It's an incredibly densely packed world, and so we love when people find the optional stuff, and that's one of those key moments that I think people react to, and partly because it's not forced on them.
Scott Steinberg in St. Louis. apart from the sort of mission accomplished angles that emerge in games, in this game, where did it take your mind? I mean, if we think, was there an intellectual journey here? Was there an emotional journey? How would you describe that?
I would describe it as all of the above, and Ken actually belies himself when he talks about densely packed. I have never seen anything so dense. In fact, one of the most poignant moments for me was standing in a somber garden, a monument to martyrdom, and simply looking at a statue of an angel with tears pouring down its eyes. It was a fountain, and I've never seen anything like this in a video game. And what's fascinating about it is the difficulty of the topics that it tackles. So you're not only gunning down KKK-like figures at certain points, but you're actually staring at stained glass windows that deify our founding fathers, fighting with robots that have porcelain doll faces of George Washington and are carrying guns. So at every single moment, the game pushes you and makes you stop and think. And actually what I found was the moments of violence oftentimes interrupted their narrative. And so it was very curious in that regard, and that you had almost an anti-first-person shooter in that it was storytelling, its narrative. It's almost role-playing game-like in it, the way that it presents everything, and that you have the option to make choices. And I think that's why games resonate so powerfully, is that you are the character. You step into their shoes. It's not a passive experience. And at every single turn, I'm looking at the possibilities going, there's no end. Yes, there's a linear path. Yes, there are optional choices to get to the end destination so you can see more of the story. But you could simply stop and take a tour of this world, and you would be amazed at what you would find.
Kate in New Orleans. Kate, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for having me on the show.
Yeah.
I was calling to see if you guys can maybe talk a little bit more about the role that gender plays in this video game. I know that you had made a comment earlier in the show about how, you know, you were happy that there was a woman who is a major player in this video game,
yeah.
Elizabeth.
Yes.
But I was wondering if you had considered any kind of gender roles that Elizabeth would play as you were developing her character.
Ken, how about it? I mean, she's still the damsel in distress here. What about gender roles in BioShock Infinite?
Well, she starts the game as the damsel in distress. Mm-hmm. She's actually the most powerful person in the story. And I think what's interesting, and I'm trying not to spoil anything for the fans, is how Booker and Elizabeth change each other. And I think that's it's really not a story. Like, a lot of games are a story about the world ending or a terrorist attack. That's not there's a lot of story elements, larger story elements. But this is a story of a relationship. And in most ways, I think I really view Elizabeth as the protagonist. Though both characters go through change. Elizabeth is the one you really watch transform through the course of the game because the events affect her. And that, to me, was extremely important. Also, my collaboration with Courtney Draper, who helped me in many cases, you know, build this character. At times I'd come in and I'd have a scene that wasn't working. And Courtney just understood the character so well that she'd be like, well, what if Elizabeth said this here? What if Elizabeth said that here?
What about your investors, your backers? There's a lot of money in this. In the movie world, we well know the pattern where, you know, a director may be told to sex it up or bloody it up. Do you have that kind of pressure or not?
I think that, you know, as the first game in this series was set in a underwater objectivist utopia. So I think already you can see I work for a company that is willing to take risks. They exerted absolutely zero creative control on this game. They understand that they hire people to make this, and they understand that they have to put the bets on those people.
Nick in New York City. Nick, thanks for calling. You're on with Ken Levine.
Hi, thanks for calling. Hi, Mr. Levine. Thank you very much for your work. You're one of my personal heroes for the last 6 years as a student. I've watched every interview you've done so far because I've completed the game the first day it came out, and I've actually been waiting for my Songbird edition because it's a little backward, but it's fine. But I was just wondering, since after the first game had a lot of objectivist ideologies, and I've read most of Ayn Rand's books because of that, and I was wondering if there's any similarity into your influence with BioShock Infinite. Were there any literary influences that you had that played a big part in the game, or movies, or because I saw you mentioned There Will Be Blood.
Yeah,
I was wondering if there are any other influences that I can look for, because I just, after completing the game, I just want more, and I know the DLC is coming out. But I was just wondering if there was anything else that, you know, us gamer addicts, BioShock Infinite addicts, can read while we wait.
Nick, we've got it. Thanks for that, Ken.
Yeah, we didn't have anything. We didn't have a personages as particular as Ayn Rand to draw from this time. But if you look at Comstock, you know, he is sort of a combination of Joseph Smith and Teddy Roosevelt, and, you know, the nationalist instincts of Teddy Roosevelt, and the sort of religious instincts of a Joseph Smith, And then, you know, you have this sort of all the American can-do-itness of a Daniel Plainview, you know, and that hard, rugged frontier
that
edge.
There will be blood idea.
Mm-hmm. So I think if you're interested in sort of a reading list, I'd start with The Devil in the White City is a great book that sort of sets
terrific
up the period.
Book. The Chicago World's Fair.
Yep, mm-hmm. Yep. That sets up the period. There's a documentary, a PBS documentary called America 1900, which just really lays out the period in a very sort of in a smart, simple way that gives you a context of what was going on and what was so important about the period.
Nick, enjoy those. Adam in Jersey City, New Jersey. Adam, you're on with Ken Levine.
Hi. One of my favorite features of the story is that it has this surface level of social commentary and, hopefully without giving too much away, a deeper love letter to quantum physics. Which level of the narrative was your starting framework, and was it difficult to maintain both aspects?
Oh, I love it, Adam. Thank you. Ken, first explain to us, if you would, for those who haven't seen it, how your video game can be a love letter to quantum physics.
So the city itself is we actually consulted with an MIT physicist on this game. And, of course, it's in the same way the genetic technology was fantastical in Bioshock 1. The quantum mechanics are somewhat fantastical in this, but we wanted to have a basis in reality. So the city is held aloft through an invention of quantum mechanics by one of the characters in the game. And the whole story is sort of the precedent, the whole story, the setting of the whole story is that these tears exist, which are essentially holes between versions of
time
reality.
Space. Yeah.
Times, you know, the many worlds theory mm-hmm. of mm-hmm. quantum mechanics. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of a conceit of the game and the key to Elizabeth's power.
She has particular access to those.
Yes. Mm-hmm. She uniquely has access to that.
Scott, did you feel that love letter to quantum mechanics running through this?
I certainly saw that, and I saw a love letter to storytelling and video game making more so than anything else. So there are a number of themes that are interwoven throughout, but it's absolutely fascinating the level of sophistication with which Ken and Irrational have treated players. And so the story covers all the themes that we talked about prior, and it really challenges the players. And actually what's surprising is that we haven't seen this as often as we might have in video games before. We have to keep in mind this is a medium that's 40 years old. Gamers are more sophisticated these days. The average player is in their 30s. Oftentimes they're half male, half female, even split there as far as the audience population. And what Ken's doing is he's really raising the bar here. And what the game does is presses you to think further and gives you so many jumping off points if you want to do further research into a number of topics that over the years games have steadily matured. But it's fascinating to me. You know, if you look at some of the biggest blockbusters out there now, L.A. Noire, titles like Dishonored, Uncharted 2, Half-Life 2, what we keep seeing is just like with TV shows like The Walking Dead and Game of Thrones, that creativity and storytelling are quickly becoming killer apps. And what they've done here in Bioshock Infinite is very much make them central characters as much as, of course, Booker and Elizabeth.
I wonder, Ken, is there a point at which the convention of the shooter may recede? Something. We have one listener, so many comments here, but Alan says, I can understand the enjoyment people get from video games. And then he raises several questions or concerns, but among them he says, I do have a hard time understanding how after the Newtown Massacre, a producer can put up for sale something that elevates and teaches violence. I mean, and you've got, you know, all these questions and reports that, in fact, there may be a link mm-hmm. between what people absorb in video games and what we see in the streets. Where do you see that connection going, Ken? Does that very common link get broken at some point in gaming, or is it always there? Certainly, the gun shows up in Hollywood practically forever.
Yeah, I mean, violence, for better or for worse, is, you know, going back to the dawn of narrative is a part of the storyteller's toolkit. I think, you know, there's a couple questions here. One is, I remember when I was a kid, I grew up, I wasn't a very popular kid. I was a nerdy little kid, mm-hmm. and I didn't have friends, and I didn't have because I wasn't very good at socializing. Mm-hmm. And I found Dungeons and Dragons. And if you remember back in the 70s, there was this big hue and cry about Dungeons and Dragons being, you know, kids were going off and killing themselves
and disappearing
into caves.
Yeah.
And that happened with comic books, and that happened with rock and roll music, sort of, you know.
Okay, but there's Adam Lanza with those 20 little kids beneath him.
Yeah, there is, absolutely. And I'm not trying, no way am I trying to minimize.
So your point is?
My point is that there's, for me personally, games were a way around being that kid. you know, for me personally. And I'm not speaking as a scientist here. You know, we can argue the science, but you're probably not – I'm not the best guy to do that. You know, I was talking about it with my my in-laws are both are psychologists and psychiatrists, and we were talking about it yesterday, and they have their own opinion, and they feel it's very they don't believe in they think the science points the opposite way of what you're
saying. There's not a connection. What about the upside? As a creative director, are you looking to expand the human experience, to even lift it?
Yeah, and I think the other point is there's the, you know, they call them first-person shooters, FPS. There's the F, there's the FP, the first-person aspect of being, inhabiting a character's role. And there's the S part, which is the shooter part. I'm not sure they're not necessarily one and the same. Games, what makes a game generally is some form of challenge component. But that, whatever that challenge, you know, whether it's a puzzle or shooting or sports or whatever it is, I'm not always sure that that's going to be a place in the things I make, you know, not because I have a problem with them at all, but because I think you do start to get to almost a musical theater thing where all of a sudden there's this conceit of breaking out into song in the same way there's this conceit of breaking out into shooting that is, it can be odd at times.
Certainly, the nuance and complexity and options of behavior just explode in this one, BioShock Infinite. Scott Steinberg is with TechSavvy Global, been with us from St. Louis. Scott, thanks for your insights today. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks, Tom.
And Ken Levine, creative director at Irrational Games of BioShock Infinite. Ken, thank you. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Tom.
A little more Tears for Fears ragtime version from BioShock Infinite. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.